This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The U.S. has now shot down four objects that entered American airspace. The high-altitude Chinese surveillance balloon shot down 10 days ago, and three other as-of-yet unidentified objects over the weekend. As for those three, there's been enough speculation about their origins that this week, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre felt compelled to state on the record,
"There is no, again, no indication of aliens or extraterrestrial activity with these recent takedowns. Again, wanted to make sure that the American people knew that, all of you knew that, and it was important for us to say that from here because we've been hearing a lot about it."
So the truth is still out there. But in all seriousness, the air incursions are no laughing matter because they signal out in the open the latest escalation in tensions between the United States and China. Biden administration officials John Kirby of the National Security Council and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, who was in Brussels yesterday, both said the objects indicate the extent of China's operations in and over the United States.
"We don't know if they were actually collecting intelligence, but because of the route that they took, out of an abundance of caution, we want to make sure that we have the ability to examine what these things are and potentially what they were doing."
"We were able to determine that China has a high-altitude balloon program for intelligence collection that's connected to the People's Liberation Army. It was operating during the previous administration, but they did not detect it. We detected it. We tracked it. And we have been carefully studying it to learn as much as we can."
In fact, the Biden administration last week claimed that China had sent surveillance balloons over more than 40 nations on five continents. Meanwhile, in China, Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin said yesterday that it's the United States that repeatedly violates Chinese national security. "The intrusion of airspace by U.S. balloons is commonplace. Just last year, U.S. high-altitude surveillance balloons entered Chinese airspace more than 10 times without the approval of the relevant Chinese authorities," Wang said. He went on and added, "The first thing the U.S. should do is start with a clean slate, undergo some self-reflection instead of smearing and accusing China," end quote. Well, National Security Council spokesperson Adrian Watson immediately denied China's claims about American spy balloons, calling it, quote, "the latest example of China scrambling to do damage control." Well, tensions have been high between the U.S. and China for some time. And as Chinese economic, military, and political power grows and reshapes our multipolar world, diffusing those tensions will not happen anytime soon. But what's fascinating about this moment is how the visual evidence of a wayward spy balloon has put the depths of U.S.-China tensions out in the open and made them unavoidable to us all. So what should we be understanding about what we're seeing? Well, that's why we've brought back Oriana Skylar-Mastro to the show today. She's a fellow at Stanford University's Freeman Spolye Institute for International Studies, also a non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and author of The Costs of Conversation, Obstacles to Peace, to Peace Talks in Wartime. And I should also know that Oriana continues her service in the U.S. Air Force Reserve, though she is not here today speaking on behalf of the Air Force. Oriana, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, let me just ask you, what's your best guess about the three objects that were shot down over the weekend? Do you hazard a guess about what they are?
Well, I have to say, you know, I'm supposed to be an expert on these things, but there's a lot about these incidents that is really confusing. On one hand, I can't quickly say that these are Chinese surveillance objects. They were of a different size, smaller. They were flying at a different altitude, much lower. So it's possible that this is something that is completely independent of the Chinese surveillance balloon. On the other hand, one of the alternative hypotheses is this could potentially be like a commercial asset, just like commercial entities have their own satellites. They might also have their own high-altitude balloons. But then it's confusing to me why, if the United States shot down, for example, some sort of Google platform, that Google wouldn't have come out and said something about it. So the fact that it's still unknown after so many days suggests to me that it must be some sort of diplomatically sensitive issue.
But that doesn't seem to be what the Biden administration is saying about why it took that action over the weekend, because shooting down something over U.S. airspace is a big deal. I mean, you heard Secretary Austin there talk about, well, it was a danger to civilian aircraft. I mean, I presume that such objects, whether or not they're intelligence-gathering objects or civilian ones, are in the skies all the time. Why suddenly shoot three of them down?
So my assessment of this, and I don't want to give too much sort of fodder to the Chinese who are trying to say that the U.S. response is driven by domestic political reasons. The United States is concerned about these surveillance balloons largely because of national security. But I do think the other objects, potentially the reaction could have been driven by the fact that the American people are now very focused on the idea that there are objects in the airspace that potentially the United States is not tracking and is not dealing with. And so given that, the Biden administration might have felt compelled to take some more aggressive action to clear that airspace to show the American people that they have this under control. Or it's possible that they are extremely dangerous items, but then we would question why the Biden administration hasn't clarified that at this point.
Okay. A couple more questions about the three this weekend, because they happened in such quick succession. And please, just correct me if I'm wrong, but did the United States sort of change radar monitoring protocols over that area of U.S. airspace following the shooting down of the first balloon earlier this month? And is that why we perhaps detected more activity in U.S. airspace?
Well, I will say that the United States and air defense is an extremely important and an extremely sensitive topic. One of the things that have come up in the Chinese media and the Chinese discussion of these high-altitude balloons, for example, is to say that they demonstrate that the United States doesn't have control over its airspace and cannot defend its airspace the way that the United States tries to present it. That's a very dangerous narrative. And when I have asked people in the administration about it, saying we should clarify this because the United States does have the ability to protect its own airspace because of the sensitivities of the technology and what the United States does and does not have, how we respond to incursions. A lot of that type of information, what our radars sense, what they don't sense, is not available for public consumption.
Okay. But nevertheless, I mean, I'm asking you this, Oriana, because of your expertise in Chinese military and security issues, also your service, particularly
right.
in the Air
right.
Force. But the fact that the United States took this action, have we shown our hand a little bit in terms of what our capabilities are?
So if I can just be clear that this is speculative,
yes.
but if you want me to speculate, Meghna, what I would say is
it's the best we can get because the administration is not being forthcoming.
Exactly, yeah. exactly. And on your show, I can be very determined about the things I know and do not know. And hopefully my confidence on some of the Chinese behavior comes through. But on this, I can just speculate. The United States has a lot of capabilities, right? But we don't employ all of those capabilities all the time. There are trade-offs based on priority. And there are some capabilities, military capabilities, the United States doesn't have just because it's never been a priority. So, for example, China is much better at shooting ships from its coast than the United States is. That's largely because China made that a priority given U.S. military operations in its vicinity. The United States doesn't have a lot of ships of other countries sailing close to us, right? Mm. This is also why I find it very credible that the United States doesn't have a program like this. Not only did the White House state that the United States doesn't have this program, but it wouldn't make any sense for us to have it because the United States can use aircraft and ships to conduct surveillance from international waters and international airspace against China. China can't project power that far to the United States. So there's a lot of cases of capabilities where maybe China has something that we don't have, not because there's no tech, that we don't have the technology, or, it's just that it hasn't been a priority. So what I would speculate is, probably the United States has known about these objects for some time. They weren't on the list of the top threats to the U.S. homeland. And so we were using our air defense capabilities, radar detection to track other types of threats. And now that this has become much more of a public issue, it's quite possible that we've redirected some of those resources to better track balloons in our airspace.
Well, I'm seeing here today, in fact, in the New York Times, reporters there were able to speak with members of the Biden administration. And they say, quote, U.S. officials said in interviews that regarding that first spy balloon that was shot down on February 4th, that, quote, they began tracking the spy balloon as it lifted off from Hainan Island in southern China in late January. So, just want to be clear about something, Oriana. You're very confident with the assessment that it was indeed a Chinese high-altitude surveillance balloon?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. There's a lot of reasons why China always is going to deny. I mean, this is a key part of their strategy. It's been a key part of their strategy for 20 years. When you look at how they act in the South China Sea vis-a-vis Taiwan, you know, just like you have swarms of hundreds of boats to like keep the Philippines from resupplying some islands, and the Chinese say, oh, these are just fishermen hiding from the weather, but they have no fishing equipment, you know, on them, and instead they have weapons or other platforms. You know, we can tell based on what that object is doing, what it's carrying, its general purpose. And it's kind of a trope to say that it's a weather balloon. It's kind of like every time a country has to deal with a satellite in space, we're always like, oh, it's just our weather satellites. Like, we all know that the satellites are conducting surveillance and reconnaissance. So the Chinese, they take it to a different level of deniability. What's interesting to me is the fact that China hasn't changed their strategy at all in like 20 years. If you look back, we had an incident in 2001, that was very similar, the EP3 incident. They held hostage U.S. forces for this whole period of time, and it was all over reconnaissance and surveillance. So this is not a new issue between the two countries.
Well, Oriana Skylar-Mastro, stand by for just a moment. When we come back, I want to, again, use your expertise to help us understand some of the details about China's surveillance program. And then also, we'll talk about really what's being revealed about the diplomatic situation between Washington and Beijing. So, more in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Oriana Skylar-Mastro is with us today, and we're talking about what we need to understand regarding the objects in U.S. airspace that the Biden administration has shot down, and more importantly, what it reveals about the state of diplomacy between the United States and China. And Oriana, I would love, again, to get your assistance in clarifying some of the details about what's happened and what's been claimed over the past, let's say, 4 days, okay? Because I played that tape earlier from China's foreign ministry spokesman, where he said that the U.S. has its own high-altitude surveillance program and made incursions in Chinese airspace more than 10 times last year. What is your response to that? Because it seems to me that, I mean, the Biden administration denies it, but if that's the case, doesn't it seem odd that we wouldn't have a balloon surveillance program?
I mean, honestly, if I don't get tenure at Stanford, I feel like I could get a job as a foreign ministry spokesman for the PRC, because I know exactly what they're going to say regardless of the situation. I mean, there's always going to be some phrase in there like thieves shouldn't point at thieves and those who hide in caves shouldn't come out into the light. I mean, the bottom line is that the Chinese really confuse the situation. There's sort of a discomfort and an awkwardness from these types of denials or these types of accusations. It's really hard to prove that things don't exist that don't exist. And so what ends up happening is the United States then starts scrambling to be like, how we don't have this program, so how do you prove you don't have something that doesn't exist? And it really diverts our resources. It's been a strategy that the Chinese, as I was mentioning before the break, have used for quite some time in their coercive diplomacy, especially in the South China Sea, of just even denying that they are where they are, denying that they do things that they're doing. If this were a weather balloon, the Chinese could have easily demonstrated that. If it had drifted into U.S. airspace and was just a weather balloon, you would have thought that the Chinese government would have given the United States a call to prevent an international incident and said, oh my gosh, we're so sorry, you know, a wind blew this balloon and, you know, into your airspace, you know, let's work together to deal with it. But obviously that's not the case. And the United States has been tracking this balloon since it took off. And that's sort of another point. It's not that we, you know, all of a sudden, it would be very random for us to notice all these objects for the first time, and we never noticed them before. I think the United States government did know that some of these objects were there. It just wasn't, you know, on the priority list of dealing with things, because there's all ways that China is conducting surveillance and reconnaissance. I mean, they have a massive space program where they're launching, you know, more satellites than any other country into space. I find it particularly interesting that their manned space program falls under the military arm and not the civilian arm of their space program. You know, like, what's that about? We know that, you know, the United Work Front of China sort of on the ground trying to shape public opinion, co-opt elites. Like, there's a lot of different national security challenges. And these balloons, until very recently, just didn't make the list.
But so much of what you said, though, sounds familiar from the U.S. context. I mean, we have Space Force. The U.S. civilian space program got started because of the Cold War. Yes. I mean, these are all familiar means of understanding how a great power is trying to operate, especially in competition with another. But I just want to get some clarity here. I mean, we too have I'm guessing we have the most satellites in the sky
yes.
of yes. any nation on planet Earth. I mean, so what purpose would a balloon program serve? Or let me just ask you, what purpose does it serve for China, since at least we can confirm that there was one high surveillance satellite, high altitude surveillance balloon over our skies? Why? When, I mean, satellites do a pretty darn good job.
So first, let me say, in response to the idea of how great powers compete, I'm finishing a book right now primarily about how China competes. And one of the interesting points is, while we assume emulation, we assume China will do things exactly the way the United States does, actually, to be competitive, they do things slightly differently a lot of the time. So on the surface, sometimes it looks like we're doing the same things, right? Mm-hmm. Like, China declares an air defense identification zone. All countries have those. But China reserves the right to shoot down a plane that's not flying towards them. That's unique, flying parallel. Or we all conduct surveillance and reconnaissance, but we don't gather commercial information and then give it to our companies for them to have an edge. Only China does that. Surveillance and reconnaissance, there are rules of engagement. The United States, again, there's a reason why we wouldn't have these types of balloons, and then I'll go to why China does. We conduct surveillance and reconnaissance primarily with satellites, and then we have in-theater assets. So these are aircraft and ships that are flying and sailing in international waters and international airspace, but have the range to be gathering some information on other countries, right? And so this is seen by international law. This is okay because we're not in these countries' territory. This balloon was in U.S. territory. Mm-hmm. That makes it fundamentally different. Now, why does China need something like this? Satellites have limitations. Mm-hmm. First and foremost is that you can't maneuver them. So it's not the case that you're like, I want to see, there's something happening at this airbase in the United States. I want images of it in 2 hours. It's like, well, we won't have a satellite over that area in 2 hours. And that's that. There's nothing you can really do about that. So states try to position satellites to get some coverage, but you don't have full coverage. And then it's also the case that countries know when satellites are passing overhead. So they can sort of easily hide things and maneuver things based on when those satellites are coming around. If they are coming around, or, you know, if they're stationary and just staying over one object too, you have a sense of those things. Now, the balloons, the idea here, and what I would find interesting, though I don't know because this hasn't been reported on, but I'd like someone to tell me kind of about the propellant on this balloon. I want to know how maneuverable it is. It's obviously not the case that they just send it up in the air and then the winds sort of take it. There has to be some limited maneuverability in which it can be set on one course or another course. But the degree to which they can maneuver it to go over certain objects, that is an advantage over a satellite. It's also the case that it's less observable. Sometimes the lower technological levels of something makes it so they're less, you know, identified. You know, if you have an airplane that is made up of primarily of wood, probably radar is not going to detect it versus something, you know, that's more advanced. You know, I was just watching Andor the other day, this Star Wars series on Disney, and they did this whole thing in which, like, the rebels are using radios that are so old that, you know, the Empire doesn't notice the frequencies. You know, whoever they had advising on that show, that was, like, a very good point. So it's possible that that's the case with these balloons, right? They were at a certain level, low observable, so radars weren't detecting them. And there's some deniability there. When the United States flies a military aircraft to gather intelligence, like, it's very hard to say that that's not what we're doing. But with a balloon, you know, you can say, like, oh, this was just for weather purposes, and confuse the situation. So there's technological, you know, sometimes you can get closer with the balloon, so your imagery is of a higher quality, higher resolution, potentially isn't, you know, disturbed as much by weather as a satellite image would be. So you can have longer time on target, higher resolution, greater stealth, and of course, they are much, much cheaper than satellites are, and much, you know, lower tech.
Yeah, you know, just as a little sidebar story, we can move satellites. Colonel Larry Wilkerson told me some time ago that when he was chief of staff for then Secretary of State Colin Powell, and they were amassing data to convince the UN that an invasion of Iraq was warranted, right, in 2002, he told me that in order to get the imagery that they needed, because people on the ground in Iraq knew about what time the U.S. satellites would fly over, they moved a satellite. And he told me, quote, it was at very great expense to the American people. So it's possible, but seemingly rarely done. Now, I want to expand our conversation. I could talk with you all hour, Oriana, about the how to understand sort of the technical implications of what has happened over the past few days. But really, the diplomatic and national security situation is also what I need to get a deeper understanding of. So let me just first of all play a little bit of tape that we got from Tong Zhao, frequent guest on this show and senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment in Beijing. And we asked him how the continuing developments around this spy balloon have unfolded from his perspective.
I think initially the two sides handled the crisis very well. There was an immediate phone call between Wang Yi and Secretary Blinken, and they exchanged information. I think it was the decision to shoot down the balloon that somehow made China think this is an overreaction by the United States. And therefore, China needs to also retaliate by sending a strong message. So, you know, it looks like both countries' systems, there is a strong domestic pressure to appear determined to defend one's image, reputation, and the interests. And in both systems, they, I think, failed to adequately mitigate the domestic pressure.
Tong then added that he thinks the impact on China's government and the way it's approaching this situation may be larger than the Biden administration realizes.
Although they agree that the Biden administration, the executive branch, may have very limited control of how the American public reacts to the crisis, it made the Chinese experts believe that there is such a strong anti-China sentiment in the U.S. society as a whole. The horse has already left the barn. It is too late to try to reason with the United States. I think if China came away from this incident with that type of belief, it will only further discourage China from engaging in genuine and good faith diplomatic exchanges with the United States.
That's Tong Zhao of the Carnegie Endowment in Beijing. Well, I want to bring Susan Shirk into the conversation. She joins us from San Diego, California, and she's chair of the 21st Century China Center at the University of California, San Diego, author of the new book, Overreach, How China Derailed Its Peaceful Rise. Susan Shirk, welcome.
Thanks, Meghna. Nice to be here, especially with Oriana.
Yeah. How do you read the responses? How would you interpret the responses from both the Biden administration and the Chinese government in the past few days?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that Tong Zhao, who's a very good scholar and someone I respect a lot, is not correct about the crisis management of the Chinese side and the U.S. side, because there was not an immediate phone call. The United States was trying to communicate, and the Chinese side was refusing to pick up the phone or saying we need more time to figure this out. And the phone call between Wang Yi and Blinken actually came quite a few days after the crisis began. At which demonstrates that we have, especially on the Chinese side, there's internal coordination problems, and then there's a big problem with communication between the two countries. In recent days, with three more objects being shot down, and the United States not being able to let the public or anyone know yet what these objects were, definitely has created a more confusing situation. And the Chinese side has used this time to kick their own sand into the perceptions of the world about what is going on. And Oriana did a very good job of describing the damage control that the Chinese side has used in the past and is using here, some of which even includes just pure distraction of focusing on, apparently I was reading last night about a train accident in the United States, you know, with some lethal chemicals on board. So they try to find ways to preserve their own innocence by distracting the public with a lot of different methods.
Well, so let me turn back to Oriana for a moment, because today we're hearing that it's possible that Secretary of State Anthony Blinken and Wang Yi, China's top diplomat, may meet at the Munich Security Conference beginning on February 17th, which would be the first time that they would meet since the start of this balloon incident. And of course, Blinken had canceled his trip to Beijing in response to when the balloon was first detected. Oriana, is that progress in your mind?
So as you know, Meghna, I wrote a book called The Costs of Conversation
yes.
about the role of talks, primarily in wartime. But there's a few conclusions after doing a number of historical cases, primarily about Chinese behavior during conflicts. The first one is we've sort of socially constructed this thing in which talking can look like weakness. I mean, we do it in our personal lives, right? Today's Valentine's Day. So maybe we can talk about, you know, how many days you have to wait before you call someone if you like them type of thing. And we do it in politics. We have to stop treating diplomacy as a reward. Because when we do that, then we get into these cycles in which when China feels weak, when it feels on its back foot, it cuts off all interactions with the United States to say, you know, we are resolved and we don't care where this is going, because we are willing to take the risks associated with lack of talking. And now what's interesting is the United States, with not to say that this wasn't the right move, but when Secretary Blinken decided to postpone the visit, he was taking on a similar approach. Now, if the two sides finally come together, I say all of that just because we have to understand the context under which they're doing this. Talking in and of itself doesn't actually always lead to good things. That's why it can take years for two sides to talk to each other before a war comes to an end. Sometimes, you know, in the Vietnam War, we used to say the Vietnamese, we should just sit there and read the phone book because of how useless it was to come into the room with them. So it really depends on where the Chinese mindset is. And I think based on the statements they've been making, the deniability, the strategies that Susan was just highlighting, I don't see a situation under which we get into the room and the Chinese are in a position to move the relationship forward.
Maybe I can jump in here.
Yeah, just Susan, just so you know, we have about 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break, but go ahead.
Okay, well, expectations even for the original Blinken-Wang Yi meeting in Beijing were fairly low. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we should expect any great breakthroughs, but I definitely think starting to talk is breaking the ice is very important.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're getting some comments here from listeners on social media. On Twitter, AJ Huff says, China's playing a long chess game. I believe the purpose of the balloon or balloons is less about spying and more about learning our responses, kind of like the velociraptors testing the fences in Jurassic Park. Well, Susan Shurkin, Oriana Skylar-Mastro, we'll talk more about actually what Washington's response tells us about the U.S.'s position and strengths and weaknesses in this whole event. And that's what we'll talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we're trying to understand what we need to learn from the existence of a Chinese high-altitude spy balloon in U.S. airspace. That one was shot down on February 4th from the other three unidentified objects that the U.S. shot down over the weekend, and what it reveals about the current state of diplomacy between the United States and China. I'm joined today by Susan Shirk. She's chair of the 21st Century China Center at the University of California, San Diego, author of Overreach, How China Derailed Its Peaceful Rise. Oriana Skylar-Mastro joins us as well. She's a fellow at Stanford University and a non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, author of The Costs of Conversation, Obstacles to Peace Talks in Wartime. She's also continues her service in the United States Air Force Reserve, though not with us speaking for the Air Force today. Now, Oriana and Susan, just hang on for a second, because I want to take a quick sidebar into the existence of these high-altitude balloons, both for scientific research and for surveillance. So we reached out to Jamie Jacobs, who's a professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at Oklahoma State University and director of the Unmanned Systems Research Institute. And we asked him to tell us more about the balloons that are in the skies, both here and around the world.
Most of our atmospheric weather observations that we get that are very crucial to accurate weather forecasts are provided by weather balloons launched by the National Weather Service. And there are dozens of these that are launched around the continental U.S. on a daily basis. So these balloons go up. They carry a very small payload, you know, on the order of ounces aloft with them that radio the information on the atmosphere back down towards the ground across the globe. So you can have dozens to 100 balloons on a daily basis that are being launched, performing some kind of scientific mission.
Besides monitoring weather, we also asked Professor Jacobs what else the balloons might be used for.
And then you have other high-altitude observational balloons, which might be used for things such as pollution measurements, you know, being able to do things like even high-altitude aeronomy, looking for insects that might operate at high altitude. You know, a new problem that we have now is microplastics, and we're not only finding those in the ocean, we're also finding those in the atmosphere. But doing things such as ozone measurements, balloons are really the best way that we can use to observe the atmosphere. Rockets go through the atmosphere too quickly, and aircraft don't fly high enough to be able to do that.
So some of those balloons may stay aloft for as much as a month, by the way, but they all do come down eventually. So we asked Professor Jacobs, can people at times step out of their front doors to find parts of these civilian balloons, let's put it that way, the canopies draped over trees in their yards?
It's not uncommon. Most of these systems are just out there somewhere, not recovered, but it is common. And you know, most of these will say, you know, this is not a harmful device. It belongs to the National Weather Service. You can return it to this address or discard it. And so you can, you know, go to eBay, for example, and find some of these systems that have been collected and the people are selling them on eBay. But they're not good for much after they've been used this one time.
So that was Jamie Jacobs, director of the Unmanned Systems Research Institute at Oklahoma State University. Okay, so that brings back to mind the three objects that were shot down this weekend by the U.S. government. Still no word about exactly what they were. Those objects and the balloon on February 4th were all shot down by Sidewinder missiles. Each one costs more than $400,000. So Connecticut Congressman Jim Himes, top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, says vigilance in protecting U.S. skies is important, but hypervigilance is another.
What I do worry about is, and again, we need to know what these things are. I think it's going to turn out to be a lot less that meets the eye. But a military mission to shoot down a balloon is a very, very expensive thing. And now we've got teams in the Arctic and teams in Canada trying to recover these things. We can't make it the policy of the United States, I think, in the long run, if I'm right, and these are, you know, errant weather balloons, to deploy the military to take down these balloons every time we find them. So we'll need to think a little bit harder about that.
That's Congressman Jim Himes of Connecticut. So Susan Shirk, how do you read what not only the Biden administration's response has been in the past couple of weeks, how they've handled this situation, but also, I mean, how the U.S. media has been portraying it about our focus as a nation amongst the American people about, you know, getting our blood pressure up over the existence of these objects?
Well, I guess Tung Zhao is right in the sense that it is revealing about the sentiment of the American public right now and the very deep concern about China as a threat, security threat, as well as an economic threat to the United States. And I was quite struck with the statement that was put out by the two new heads, the Republican and the Democratic members of Congress, who are the co-chairs of this new House Select Committee on China, which doesn't have the ability to legislate, but they're going to pronounce and do a lot of hearings. And Mike Gallagher and Congressman Krishnamurti, the two points they made were, we see from this spy balloon, of course, they're just talking about the first one, as proof that China is a threat to the American homeland, not just to the distant shores on other parts of the, not just to our allies in Asia, for example. And the second thing they said was pretty fascinating, which is that the current diplomatic overtures by China are not actually a substantive change, not a thaw. They were eager to use the example of the spy balloon as an argument against what many people have noticed, which is there is some moderation of Chinese foreign policy as well as domestic policy underway right now. But they want to say there isn't a thaw. This regime is as hardline as ever. And then you see a lot of other statements, especially by members of Congress, mm-hmm. because when people are paying attention to an issue, just like, use of drugs in professional athletics or, you know, any issue that becomes what people talk about over the proverbial water cooler, then it's an opportunity for members of Congress to express their own views and appeal to their followers. So I think that's a lot of what's going on. It's so visible, so interesting, so kind of silly in one way, because it's a balloon, that people are paying a lot of attention to it. But from the Chinese side, I do think it confirms their perception that anti-Chinese hostility in the United States has become so inflamed that it doesn't actually matter what Chinese policies are or what they do, but we are bound to try to punish them, slow down their economic development no matter what. Yeah. And that is a very bad misperception to have if you're trying to use diplomacy, including sanctions as well as reassurances, to try to induce some modification of Chinese policy.
So let me just point a couple of things out here. And Oriana, I want to turn to you on this. First of all, regarding the sort of how China is talking about its interpretation of the U.S.'s response, I'm seeing here that there was a recent editorial in the People's Daily, obviously a paper of the Chinese Communist Party, calling Washington's response evidence that shows, quote, to the world how immature and irresponsible, indeed hysterical, the United States has been in dealing with the case, end quote. However, there's something that Susan said that I'd love to hear your take on, Oriana, and that is, okay, it's one thing for members of Congress to use this moment to sort of make some political hay in their districts, but I think it's categorically another thing for members of Congress to come out with a statement, as Susan said, and it's true, where they're saying this incident shows that China is a threat to the American homeland. Do you think that that is the case, or not? Because it is concerning to hear that seems to be an escalation in the description of the U.S.'s position vis-a-vis China.
So this is a very important discussion to have, and it's very difficult because the answer is very nuanced, and that doesn't really carry well in the public discourse. So on one hand, you know, this Chinese position that what they do, how they act doesn't matter, you know, that the United States has these threat perceptions no matter what, I mean, that has been their message for 25 years. And in all honesty, we're talking about an overreaction right now. On the part of the United States, because the United States underreacted for so long. I see this more as like a realignment. I mean, there were decades. I was just in a meeting recently with some former secretaries of defense and joint chiefs, and one of the joint chiefs said, you know, this Taiwan issue just became an issue 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, no, it hasn't. Mm-hmm. My first job at the Pentagon, my boss told me, you know, in 2011, just to go into every meeting and say, what about China? Because no one was paying attention to it, and it, you know, wasn't on the radar. So the United States went from this, you know, basically lack of concern, even as the Chinese military was ramping up, building capabilities specifically designed to sink U.S. ships, attack U.S. bases, to this other extreme. So is it a threat to the U.S. homeland? China doesn't present right now a conventional military threat to the U.S. homeland. They cannot project power beyond basically disrupting cyber, space, and then nuclear weapons to the U.S. homeland. But that doesn't mean they're not a military threat. And so in politics, it's very difficult. I have very little patience for politics. You know, I'm a Democrat, but I'm at the American Enterprise Institute. So that can tell you how little I sort of follow political lines. But the bottom line is we need to look into U.S. responses. I don't know where this new committee is going to go, but I do think the United States has done far too little for far too long. So we go from saying China isn't a threat at all to, you know, this is an evil empire that cannot be deterred and cannot be stopped no matter what. Obviously, the truth is somewhere in the middle. The Chinese military has been preparing for 25 years to fight a war against the United States. That is just an empirical fact. Most of the territorial expansion that they want to do, their primary concern is U.S. military intervention. Mm. But that threat is limited. You know, do they want to take Taiwan by force? Yes. Do they want to control the South China Sea, East China Sea? Yes. Are they sailing to, you know, occupy Australia or, you know, Tokyo? No. And so sometimes in these discourses, we have to be very clear on what the threat actually is if we want to address it.
So that's exactly why what Susan pointed out really stands out to me, right? Because if we're trying, if indeed there's any incentive or desire, let me put it this way, desire between Beijing and Washington to cool the temperature a little bit, I don't understand how coming out with a statement from the United States Congress about China's a threat to the American homeland would do anything to help achieve that.
Well, I think there's different goals here. I can't speak for Representative Gallagher, though we've had a lot of conversations about this, so I can sort of say that my sense is there are different audiences. The United States is doing far too little and taking far too long. And so just like with General Minahan's statements about the fact that a war is coming by 2025, you know, while I don't agree with that, I think some of these groups are primarily trying to motivate not only the U.S. people, but the U.S. bureaucracy to get its act together and to enhance U.S. competitiveness in the face of this all-encompassing challenge. And so my sense is that their goal is not to calm down the diplomatic row, but to try to get the resources and the attention necessary for the United States to be able to protect its national interests.
Susan, what do you think about that?
Well, there are many things that Oriana said that I don't agree with, especially what she said about developing American strength earlier in order to be prepared to confront China if need be. I think we were doing a lot for the past several decades to strengthen the American military presence in the Asia Pacific, now the Indo-Pacific. And what we were striving to do is to induce China to rise peacefully so that it wouldn't ever be needing to use these military capabilities in order to commit aggression against Taiwan or in the South China Sea. I think that worked very well until the mid-2000s. And one of the surprises in my book, Overreach, is to show that this shift in Chinese policy actually begins before Xi Jinping. Yeah. But in any case, we also had the pivot to Asia, and we were doing quite a lot. But of course, it's these Chinese actions that have provoked this perception of the China threat. It's the overreach, the overly aggressive foreign policy, overly repressive domestic policy that has so alarmed other countries. And in the future, if Xi Jinping now has a lot of authority, if he really wanted a thaw, if he really wanted to adjust Chinese policies in order to reassure other countries that although China was a lot stronger, its intentions were more or less benign, and it didn't intend to invade another country the way Russia has, then he could do that.
Yeah, but thus far, though, it sounds like you're saying we're not seeing that yet, at least. Well, I'm afraid with that, we're going to have to wrap up this absolutely fascinating conversation. So Susan Shirk, at the University of California, San Diego, and author of Overreach, How China Derailed Its Peaceful Rise. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Magda.
And Oriana Skylar Mastro at Stanford University and the American Enterprise Institute and author of The Costs of Conversation, Obstacles to Peace Talks in Wartime. Oriana, always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.